evening, we will continue our consideration of the principles underlying the principal yogas of Indian philosophy. This evening, our subject is Bhakti Yoga. And here we come to a different level of our inquiry. As I have mentioned in some lectures, we recognize that the emotional life of the human being is deeper and older than his mental experience. And as a result of this, the authority of the emotion in the conduct of man is more direct, more forceful than the authority of the intellect. For that reason, we observe that in practical living, the mind is largely used by the average person as a servant of his emotional pressures. The person says, "I like this person." This is immediate and emotional acceptance. Then the question arises, why do I like this person? And immediately the mind begins the work of justifying the original impulse. It creates an excellent defense for the emotion. It justifies, proves, demonstrates in 100 ways that the emotional impact was legitimate, was true. We then say, "I do not like this person." And immediately the mind goes to work on a more critical basis to seek out reasons why we do not like that person. If these reasons are not immediately available, they are conjured into existence by interpretation and by the gradual reading into evidence such meaning, such intention as we require to be there. Thus we easily observe early in the study of mind phenomena that the intellect has a definite tendency to depart from fact and to act as a justification for our emotional conceptions and preconceptions. As a result of this tendency, we are frequently confronted with mental illusion, in which the mind, forced to fulfill the requirements of the emotions, must fabricate, must even extend itself into illusion and hallucination in order to sustain the original attitudes of emotional pressure. Thus the mind becomes, to a large degree, a mirror of our emotional life and a guardian or protector of our emotional attitudes as we may choose to hold. On this basis, then, it is only reasonable that any method of human improvement, any discipline for the advancement of man's spiritual and conscious should, to a degree, consider emotional phenomena, and should include within its disciplines a means of refining the emotions, even as we seek means for regenerating the body and redeeming the mental processes, as the mind must be led from error to wisdom. So the emotions must be led from excess to moderation. And this process of moderating emotional intensity is one of the basic concepts involved in Bhakti Yoga. Now, we recognize also the importance of human love. And we know that love represents one of the most positive and intense of the human emotions. We realize also that in matters pertaining to intensity of affection, the mind is obviously at a disadvantage. And therefore, most evidently, only occupies a secondary position. In attempts to prove, justify, and sustain the intensities of the affections, but it cannot successfully withstand them, nor can it rationalize successfully against their intensities. We have evidence of this in human relationships constantly. Pythagoras, who was initiated in India, finally declared that there are only three possible relations between living things, that is, especially between the members of the human family. These relations were the relation of parents, the relation of husband-wife, and the relation of the child. The husband-wife relation also carried on its own level, brother and sister relation. The relations were parental, which meant a relation to superiors in dignity, age, esteem. Affection to equals, husband, wife, brother, sister. And affection to the young, or those intellectually or spiritually immature, children. Thus, in human relationships, as Pythagoras expressed it, in doing others, all human beings were either his parents, his brothers, sisters, or his children. Now, this meant, on an emotional level, three kinds of affection, or three qualities of love. The first of these was the love of the individual for superiors, whether these superiors be his physical parents, his spiritual instructors, the older and wiser members of his own race, or the love and adoration of divine beings. These together occupy a or form a group consisting of spiritual or venerated superiors. Then there was the love of equal, those whose wisdom, knowledge, understanding were equal to his own. This was the kind of love that we share with those of our own generation, those upon our own standards of life and thinking. Then there was the love for the young, in which the person takes a naturally parental attitude toward youth, toward inexperience, toward those spiritually, intellectually, or physically uncultivated, and therefore in need of guidance and direction. The affection to the parent or to the superior being was that of adoration, the giving of self to the superior. The affection toward those of equal status was that of sharing. And the affection to those who were younger was the love of bestowing. And these became the three principal kinds of human affection. And these affections become the instruments or the elements of a great philosophical system, a system based upon the refinement of man's emotional and spiritual nature. Love, per se, as an emotion, has never been adequately defined. Plotinus, in his Essay on the Beautiful, was of the opinion that love was the instinct toward union of separated or divided parts. Therefore, that love is the instinct toward wholeness, toward completeness, toward the reunion or the attainment of yoga, which is union. Therefore, the love of our own fellow kind means to find union, to find sympathy, to find kindred with them. Whereas the love of the divine means the aspiration to attain union with the divine and to share the experience of bestowing. The bestowing of self upon that which is superior to self. Or the bestowing of self upon that which is in great need, and therefore requires our help, guidance, or kindness. In religion, we hear a great deal about love. But for the most part, we have not recognized that this emotion, like meditation on its various levels, must pass through certain disciplines or refinements if we are to elevate consciousness toward reality. We cannot, therefore, love divine things carnally, nor can we love carnal things divinely. And in the Western cultural system of which we are a part, there has been no differentiation of the basic emotion of love. We assume that we can transfer this emotion from various levels to other levels without any essential refinement or transmutation of the emotion itself. This is a very serious mistake and has led to a great many religious difficulties. For when a love which is still of a physical quality is turned upon divine things, it cannot fulfill its natural purpose because it is not sufficiently refined in itself to be able to sustain the consciousness above the material level of things. Thus we begin to consider the problem of the refinement of human affection and how we shall go about it. And to a large degree, this is carried in the great department of knowledge which is called religion. For religion is essential working with the emotion principle in man. And this emotion principle must be cultivated, must be regenerated, or as Buddhism says, must be transmuted from passion to compassion before the individual is liberated from the personal pressures of personal emotion. Now in the West, we are not inclined to regard personal emotions as in any way reprehensible, and in sober fact, they are not. Actually, personal emotions are as natural and normal to our kind as any other of the natural sensory and functional powers of man. Personal emotions, upon their own levels, have their utilities and their values. And we should not regard the neurotic frustration of these emotions as a spiritual achievement. Actually, it is a very dangerous thing to do, a procedure that is always fraught with disaster. But recognizing that we do have physical emotions, how are we going to use them constructively? Emotions are directed and moved by a center of consciousness within ourselves. Consciousness operates through emotions. Manifests a phase of its own energy, just as it manifests another phase of that energy through mental activity. Furthermore, as we go out into the abstractions of life, we realize that in the universe, love and law are identical. In the individual who mentally experiences a law as something to obey, experiences this law emotionally as something to adore. This instinct to obey is the consummation of rationalization. The instinct to adore is the consummation of the emotional instinct in the individual in relating to divine matters. Thus, there is no essential difference in the universe between love and law. One does not frustrate or neutralize the other, nor is there conflict between them. Actually, they are the mental and emotional response to one eternal and enduring fact. Mysticism has always emphasized the emotional agent as a means of bridging the interval between human and divine consciousness. Mysticism, therefore, springs out of aberration. It arises from the emotional impact of the divine presence. Thus, mysticism is of its own nature and by its own peculiar virtue, grounded in acceptances, in faith, and in hope, and in love, and in those reflexes which are essentially pointed toward adoration. The mystical experience is therefore essentially an emotional experience, and for that reason it is difficult, if not impossible, to interpret it intellectually. But we also have a serious break in our own psychic life between our mental and emotional natures is all too obvious. That which we mentally define is very seldom emotionally vitalized. And what we emotionally vitalize in its own nature, we find great difficulty in mentally defining. This interval means that we are dealing with two distinct groups of energies, although today psychology lists them together as one structure. This, it seems to me, is the result of a shortcoming in the psychological perspective, because actually these two are distinct energies of consciousness. They are not merely polarities of each other, or aspects of each other, or conditions of each other. In the Eastern disciplines, therefore, we begin by a consideration of how we shall refine the emotional attitude. How we shall take love which we have, a very personal, selfish kind of love, a self-centered kind of love, a love that sort of shares between loving others a little and loving self the more, in most instances. Actually, the average person is more fond of himself than of any other living thing. Occasionally, we get a departure from this, but it is usually represented as an outstanding virtue, because the average person does not experience it immediately in his emotional relationships. Love, on the human level, is essentially a love which desires to possess. And this arises completely from the Western concept that man can possess. Through love, we exercise a tyranny. And very often those around us find our affections a bondage. Often these affections become so excessively dominating, so intensely personal, that they really work a hardship upon our living. Yet we are so constituted that we rather expect it to be this way. We suspect unselfishness as lack of affection, and we doubt the individual's personal devotion if he does not express it by action of a possessive nature. In the East, however, we have a little different approach to this. The Easterner thinks of love not as the emotion to possess, but the emotion to release. He feels that the greatest personal devotion that he can express on a human level is that of freeing things, freeing them from him if necessary, but certainly creating the quality of freedom. Also assuming with some of the Greek philosophers that man keeps closest to himself that which he most generously releases. We are not so likely to lose those we release as those we hold on to. And because we have released by an understanding within ourselves, we are also free from the pain of loss, free from the selfish sorrows, griefs, and disturbances which rise from the sense of possession. Possession is not essentially a mental quality. Possession is an emotional impulse, an instinct. The desire to conquer the world is not basically mental. It is emotional. The mind then sets in and creates the strategy by which this emotion may be fulfilled. But the desire is basically an emotion. Anything to which the term desire may be correctly applied is emotional. Thus in the East, the beginning of the sublimation of emotion is the gradual internal realization of release. That the individual does not desire to possess, that he does not desire to bring to himself and to control that which he loves. Rather, he is impelled and inspired to generously give of his affection in a manner to create freedom for the thing loved. Now, this does not necessarily mean indifference. It does not mean that there is no longer interest, service, understanding, kinship. It means, rather, that the individual can say honestly, when he thinks he wishes to help someone else, that he wishes to help them to do the things that they want to do, rather than the things he wants them to do. And there's a great difference in these processes in practical experience. Usually, our desire for love is expressed by the fact that we know best. Therefore, those whom we love, we must protect by causing them to do the things we want them to do. If looking through our own lives, we find that our own judgment has been poor, and that probably they will not do well by doing the things we want them to do, such does not concern us. It's the instinctive desire to dominate, the instinctive desire to regulate the lives of others. We call this instinct love, but actually it is not. Because love suffereth long and is kind. And most human love does not suffer long and is not overly kind. There is, however, experience which gradually deepens human values and human emotional reactions. And there is a common ground that is established between the mind and the emotions in the field of understanding. An understanding, in this case, is an apperception of value. Understanding is the power to estimate, impersonally, the natural and real values of things. So understanding begins the process of redeeming or regenerating love. And in this process, we bring to bear upon the objects of our emotions not only our instinctive and pressureful intensities, but also a certain reflection, a certain internal morality, conscience, a consciousness quotient, by which we begin to say to ourselves, it is better to give than to receive. It is wiser to be kind than to be overly severe. And little by little, we temper our own intensities through the results of experience and through interpreting the actions of others to us, these interpretations being based upon how we have felt when others conducted themselves in certain ways. So our understanding begins the process of refining the affections of the human being. And refined from within, not by a demand, but by a growth, causes us to see that love, like mind, can grow. And that the growth of love, through the cultivation of it, through the realization of its true meaning and importance, that this growth brings to us an emotional maturity, and that we therefore can advance from one level of affection to another, deepening, enriching, broadening the program of our emotions. Now, there is a point that has been often brought up in connection with these matters, namely that the emotions of man are primeval, that they are strongly atavistic. And that under tremendous pressure, the individual breaks back and begins to reveal the most primitive emotional instincts of the jungle. That emotions are not as easily controllable. They are not as easily directed. And in anger, for example, for the veneer of civilization and perchance years of acquired attitudes dissolve. The individual returns again to the immediate emotional level of his own internal life. This does not necessarily follow in all cases, but it is true that the emotional life of the individual has been for centuries under powerful moral control, and therefore that all of his emotional maturity as he experiences it today is not real. Part of it is acquired rather than innate, and this acquired part can be removed by pressure, and the original pressures can break through. Thus, in all matters of affection, there is a tendency to recognize the individual is within himself more intense, more personal, more selfish, more self-centered than perhaps he even would like to admit that he is. And that it is only when he is able to keep his emotions in reasonable control that he is able to maintain the platform of culture to which he seems to belong. This continues because, largely, man's emotional life has been uncultivated. Just as the undisciplined child is not trustworthy, as the untrained mind is not accurate, so the uncontrolled emotions are not dependable. Thus, it becomes obvious, under stress, that we need greater emotional discipline than the average person has ever received. And that this emotional discipline is not going to be matured merely by the fact of learning. That to bring it to a reasonable degree of integration, the individual must make a distinct program out of maturing his own emotional life. How do we mature it? We do not mature anything by a forcing process, nor can we mature emotions by good reading. Nor can we mature emotions simply by refusing to give expression to undesirable ones or attempting to cultivate constructive emotional habits. These will help to a degree, but they are not the solution to the problem. The emotional life of man comes from a totality within himself. The emotional pressure bears witness to a larger part of man than his mental attitudes. Emotional pressures come from a much deeper ground, from a much older ground. Therefore, emotional maturity arises largely from the improvement of the whole person, rather than from a special discipline upon some part of the personality. We may train the hands to play the piano. We may train the mind to have a mathematical table. But if we wish to unfold the emotions, we must move from a complete and total picture. We must move from a larger foundation in elevating emotional life. This is one of the important ideas that are about to be found in the writings of Confucius. In his school in China, Confucius did not believe in the development of specialized education. He did not believe that wisdom arose from the perfection of the individual in any department of his life, but in the raising of the whole level of his being. Therefore, Confucius instructed his disciples in many subjects. He invited them to consider a variety of refinements, realizing that everything that they gained in the form of useful knowledge and understanding would have a part to play in the totality of their emotional pressure. Thus, for example, he would teach the scholar to paint. He would teach the musician to ride horseback. He would teach the mystic to mend his own garments. It was a totality that was wanted. not simply a specialization of certain knowledge. In the yogic concept, affection moved with understanding of values. For example, a mother's love for her child can be very personal and very intense, and usually is, unless there are some unnatural or unreasonable circumstances. Yet the mother's love for the child can be the undoing of the child, unless the mother herself has a certain sense of values along with this intensity of affection. The mother who through her love spoils her child has not loved the child at all. That is a difficult thing to realize. Because love, in this case, has usually been adulterated by ulterior motives. One of the most common reasons for spoiling children is that children are a little difficult. And unless you get into them more often than you should, your own composure is damaged. You haven't quite as much time to do the things you wanted to do. The child who is jumping up and down, stamping its feet, and making a general nuisance of itself is disagreeable to the parent. The parent does not like to be uncomfortable, does not like to be annoyed, does not like to be faced with a scene, does not like to be accused of cruelty and meanness and all these kind of things. So, rather for its own sake than for the sake of the child, it gives in, though perhaps fully knowing that it should not do so. It may gain a great reputation for kindliness and love, but actually these emotions are not what are involved. More thoughtfulness shows that such is not the case. What then is the proper relation of affection to the child? The answer is that the greater affection is that which serves the greater need of the child, from whatever perspective and level the parent may occupy. It is the utter consideration of the child's greater good that represents our highest conviction of what we should call love for that child. Yet in practice, we do not give that sufficient thought, because it is a little difficult and it's a little time-consuming, and it may require that we make greater change in our own lives in order to prove that we love the child. Most children who are called problem children are really children with problems, and this, in many cases, is recognizable to the parents. Therefore, instead of the parent giving the child the toy, the bottle, the ice cream cone, the money, or whatever may be involved that the child is screaming for. And in that way, stopping the uproar, at least temporarily, and establishing a precedent which will be followed by much more uproar in the course of time. The really loving parent, or the parent who really cares for the child, might say to himself or herself, why is the child like this? And might discover that the lack of harmony between the parents is a strong responsibility in this matter. Therefore, love for the child means that the parents should learn to love each other and give the example. But that is a large thing to ask. That doesn't look like love. That looks like martyrdom. Well, that actually all of the love that we talk about is already evaporated. And instead of this tremendous amount of affection being showered in all directions, we see a group of selfish people perverting principles and substituting appearances for realities. Thus, in the Oriental system, we can say, let's get at this subject of love. Let's try to find out what it really means. Let us also realize how easily this peculiarly sensitive thing can be destroyed, how it can be exploited, how it can be prostituted in a thousand ways, under a cloak of respectability that is never questioned by the public, because the public just doesn't know any better and is doing the same thing anyway. For where is your true love in this parish? It is essentially missing. And yet, if you accuse the various persons of being without this emotion, they would be righteously indignant. In the East, then, the question arises to discover at first what is love. How does it work? What are its duties and its purposes? And why has man been given this tremendous emotional capacity and yet left with this capacity so completely immature? Well, we can go a little further in this thinking, and we can say that men love each other to a degree under the heading of friendship. And yet this friendship can very quickly be corrupted into patronage. And we find the lack of the courage of the friend to correct the friend to be honest with the friend to be useful rather than merely being agreeable. Here our love in practice is a very negative thing rather than a positive one because we fear that we will offend. Therefore, we are unfair because we do not wish to offend. Our love is not strong enough to stand this strain, and the love of our friend is not strong enough for him to stand the strain if we tell the truth. So everything gets very strange. Then we go on and we consider the love of God. Now, the average human being, the love of God, is a very mysterious thing. One of the great problems in affection, in adoration, veneration, all these things, is that the object of this affection must be understandable, must be in some way apperceivable by ourselves. And in the love of God, we are loving something that is completely beyond our ordinary experience. We are loving a vast abstraction. And what we call the love that we bestow upon it is another vast abstraction. Not knowing what love is, and not knowing what God is, we love God. We cannot define our emotion towards Him. And the only way in which we can integrate it at all is to base our affection upon a personal devotion. Perhaps we have a parent whom we sincerely love. Therefore, we have an experience which we can transfer to an invisible, unknown person, the abstract being of deity. And our love for God becomes merely an extension, or to a degree, a sublimation of our love for father or mother, or our love for our country, or our love for beauty and other things of which we have some understanding and recognition. But the problem of how should deity be adored has always been a very great one. Because in popular religion, as we know it today, we are really too much like children worshiping a parent. Because not only does the parent signify strength, but the parent signifies refuge. It signifies security. It signifies the fulfillment of our desires. And because of the level of our affection, we have gradually transformed deity into a benevolent power that acts as a kind of patron or a universal philanthropist, forever attempting or presumed to attempt the fulfillment of our desires. Thus, we pray to God for help, we pray for wealth, we pray for wisdom, we pray for long life. We pray for our own success, not infrequently for the consternation of our adversaries. We wish no ill to ourselves and very little good to others. And we assume that this talent, who is the abstract counterpart of the doting ancestor in our own domestic parish, will be responsive to us in these various ways. We turn to God not to give, but to get.
not to bestow, but to receive. We're not worried about protecting God, we're much more worried about God protecting us. And little by little, we turn to deity as a benefactor, rather than as a universal power to which we owe certain responsibilities and allegiances. In yoga, comes the process then of gradually learning to experience a divine nature as an impact upon the self. In bhakti yoga, as in the other yogas, love becomes a universal power. Under such a name as Ishvara, it is a deity, a being, an all-permeating, all-penetrating, omnipresent, omniactive power. This love is everywhere abundant and superabundant. Therefore, the individual is given the possibility of seeking the experience of this love, seeking the experience of the discovery of it, not by intellection alone, but by realization, by meditation, or the continual remembrance of the presence of the divine. We have the same concept entirely in the Near Eastern mystics, the Sufis of the Dervishes, where the beloved represents universal love, deity as the infinite energy of love itself. So in the disciplines of bhakti yoga, the individual gradually comes to be receptive to the presence of divine love. Now before he can become receptive to the presence of divine love, he has to get the ego out of things. And that is the first, most difficult step perhaps there is. We are so inclined to regard all things suspiciously. We are so likely in looking around us to be displeased, to be antagonized, to say to ourselves, all the evidence that I can accumulate points to disaster, to tyranny, to cruelty, to selfishness. How then can I, as a person, having lived a life that is arduous, toil-worn, and burdened with disappointments and disillusionments, how am I to immediately apperceive the omniscience and omnipresence of divine love? The individual may say, I never received any affection from my parents, I've never received any from my children, I've had very little from the world. How then shall I discover this power to be omnipresent in all things? This is a good question. But it is a question that can be answered, but it must be answered validly. And it must perhaps be answered by a combination at first of mental and emotional factors. Remembering that the desire to love is an emotional instinct, and realizing that the mind's duty is to preserve and maintain the testimony of the emotion, we can gradually and gently bring the mind to the degree that it will defend the emotions in their positive and constructive aspects. In yoga, the disciple learns that the moment he looks for love, with an open heart, he will find it. But the difficulty has been that he hoped for love, but looked for and expected hate. That he hoped understanding, but expected to be misunderstood. Thus, with a subconscious doubt deeper than the conscious resolution, the doubt ultimately won. In order to have the kind of mystical experience that is involved in yoga, the individual must begin the gradual process of integrating a positive power of apperception. His first difficulty is, of course, that that he is unable to recognize love. He can recognize the human passions with which he is familiar. He can recognize what passes in the currency of love among mortals. But that kind of love, which is universal, he has neither experienced nor known. Therefore, he can look at it and not see it, because it may or may not resemble that which he expects. Like the small boy who wants the ice cream cone, but which cone should not be given to him because of the possible danger to his basic health. A series of ice cream cones, of course, many a small boy in Brussels before it was all said and done. But the little boy who wants an ice cream cone, asks for it and gets it, has discovered parental love. He wanted it, they gave it to him. Obviously, they love him. Now, the wiser parent says, no, you can only have one ice cream cone a week. You can't have one every time you have one. Immediately, the small boy discovers the absence of love. He does not get what he wants. Therefore, to borrow Kipling, the bottom is out of the universe. His parents are mean, nasty ogres. Nothing nice about them. 25 years later, the boy who got the ice cream cones, when he shouldn't have had, will sit down and realize that his parents were rather stupid. And he wishes that they hadn't done it. In the same way, the boy who didn't like his parents because they were more reasonable and intelligent, 25 years later, will respect them. But when the impact occurs, when we get what we want, God is ruling the universe. When we do not get what we want, the devil is in power. So looking around us, we have to begin to consider what love is, and whether love is giving us what we want, or assuring us what we need. Pythagoras said, all men know what they want, but the gods alone know what they need. The disasters that afflict us, the burdens, misfortunes, and irritations that confound us, can just as well be a greater love than we know as something unpleasant and unfair. And in the approach of mysticism to life comes the simple process of coming to understand that the universe, with all its ups and downs, with all its trials and tribulations, with all its assorted comforts and discomforts, bears witness to an integration of purpose which has behind it and within it the greater good of all. The greater good against the immediate good. And that, therefore, the universe is the wise parent. And the wise parent is finally the loving parent. Thus we can overcome certain of these outrages that rise within our natures. And we can begin to experience the possibility of loving things that are not pleasant. Loving things that are not going our way. Loving persons who have the audacity to contradict us. Loving a way of life that is hard rather than easy, because by its difficulties it hastens our own maturity. And little by little, the evil disappears out of the universe. And in the place of evil is strength. Strength serving us forever, but not serving our whims. Serving our essential progress and contributing to and hastening the day of our spiritual attainment. Now, to say this means very little. We can all say it. We can go home and be as miserable as we were before. But if, besides saying this, we are resolved within our natures to seek the good and have a conviction in us that we wish to grow, we then take this intimate confidence, which is itself mostly emotional, that we have faith in this good. And that faith is something that is real and big inside of our emotional content.
We can take this, and then we can allow the mind to go work out. And the mind working in this way begins to reveal to us a universal order rather than a universal chaos. Little by little, observation, reflection, experimentation, and tradition contribute to the justification of our instinct that the universe is right. And slowly, we come to a kind of respect, a kind of understanding, which in ourselves we know will never be subject to disillusion. Father may be God to the 5-year-old, a demigod to the 10-year-old, and gradually lose his face and countenance thereon. So by the time the child grows up, Father is really not much better than anybody else, perhaps a little worse. But in the growth of man, the divine power, which is the concept of infinite power, is something for whom admiration grows with wisdom and releases more and more a realization of the wonderful workings of this planet and the infinite benevolence of this planet. That truly, that this great creating power is aware of the sparrow's fall, and that everything that exists is enclosed within the tremendous, compassionate understanding of something that is growing and unfolding through the creatures in this fashion, and is forever revealing itself as benevolent to those themselves benevolent, and is forever nourishing and nurturing and leading man gently toward obedience, and through obedience to identification with that universal power itself. One of the great examples of this mystery, this conflict, is death itself, which, while made naturally and inevitably ordained, is met with apprehension by the average person who has not yet been able to find God in death, has not yet been able to realize that there is a larger life in which death itself is swallowed up, and that this larger life has a purpose, and that this phenomenon of death is an essential part of the benevolence of life. It is hard to appreciate these things, and yet we must come to do so. And gradually, through understanding, through the continuous meditation upon the universal good, we begin to experience the universe not as a vast pattern of laws, not as an enormous intellectual power, but as something of strangely subtle and compassionate immanence, something so near to us, something so much a part of ourselves, that truly we are never alone, but are forever within a strange, wonderful affection, which is as near to us as the air and the light and the sun. And the mystic begins to know this, begins to feel it. And in feeling it, he perceives it radiant in everything around him and in himself also. Because to find this love in every other thing and not find it in ourselves is also to fail. Gradually, through the refinement, therefore, of the available emotions of the individual, the capacity to love larger things, larger qualities and values, or as Plato expressed it, to transmute affection, elevate it from a devotion to forms until it becomes capable of being a devotion to ideas, later a devotion to principles, ultimately a devotion to being itself, which is the infinite root of all principles and all ideas. In the Buddhist metaphysical disciplines, the Bodhisattva Avalokiteshvara, the Lord of Compassion, represents the transmutation of man's emotional life. A transmutation by means of which the individual
turn gradually to the universalization of the power to love. This brings us to a second pattern that is very important. Namely, that to the average individual there are boundaries to the experience of his affections. He can find affection large enough to circumscribe his, that which belongs to himself. He can love his family. He can love his children. He can love his community. He can love his nation. But outside of the aura of his, in the sense of that which is accepted as part of himself, so that his love is all really self-love, because these things he loves because they are parts of him. They are his. Outside of that, it's a vacuum. And when word comes in the newspaper that 10 million Hindus have died of starvation, we say, well, that's just too bad. And yet we could not for a moment endure the thought of one of our own children dying of starvation. We simply are not capable of universalizing that emotion. We are not capable of an emotional experience beyond a certain gamut or a certain circle of experienced things. The individual sitting down cannot experience 10 million people dying of starvation. He is incapable of doing it, unless, perchance, he was in the midst of that. Then he may have some concept. But if he has lived a life of security, if he's lived in a community of such things do not happen, his emotional nature simply cannot respond to that. Now, he may get a response from the level of hysteria. Some individuals will get that also. He may generalize so completely on an archetypal pattern that the thought of anything, anywhere suffering, can cause him acute anguish.